Hello.
And welcome to Dragons Made Me Do It, one of potentially many podcasts about Anne McCaffrey's Dragon Riders of Pern series, but the only one by us.
I'm Shay.
And I'm Tequila Mockingbird.
And today, for our sins, we are talking about The Ford of Red Hanrahan, which is the third short story in The Chronicles of Pern First Fall.
As a warning, in this episode, we are going to be talking about racism and at some length about pregnancy, childbirth, and death in childbirth.
Not a lot happens in this one. Red Hanrahan gets permission to go north and establish what will become Ruath the Hold, and then he does that. The highlight of the story is him riding back and forth across a river a few times, thus the story title, and thus ultimately the name of Ruath the Hold, as we discussed previously, and as is glossed badly at the end of the story itself. There's not really a ton else to say in terms of plot. Mainly what this story is doing is world building and giving us background information to bridge the gap between the second crossing that we saw close up in the Dolphin's Bell and at a little bit more distance in Dragonstone, and, well, the rest of the series, but also in particular the next story, The Second Weir, which is about the establishment of Benden and several other weirs sometime further into the pass.
I definitely read this, and I definitely didn't remember any of the plot. But I do think I remembered some of the world building. There were several things that I had a vague sense of, oh yeah, there were a bunch of fevers in Fort Hold and a bunch of people died and it was really bad. And then when we were doing our bonus episode on demographics and I was looking up all the plague stuff, I couldn't find my sources on that. I was like, wait, where did we actually get that data? And it turns out it was here. So I think this stuff did seep into my consciousness of Pern as a 14-year-old, but I didn't consciously remember anything other than the riding the horse back and forth across the river 6 or 7 times.
Yeah, if I read this, it made no impression on me whatsoever. So as far as I'm concerned, I read it for the first time last week.
And it definitely has an interesting flavor of almost a myth in the sense that I think McCaffrey is very consciously trying to work back from the world building that she established in the Ninth Pass and in the previous books and trying to make that make sense with what she has now established in Dragon's Dawn. And in some places, it's a little bit rough and ready.
Yeah, and clearly this is something that she was preoccupied with because she then went on to write Red Star Rising / Dragon's Eye, which is entirely trying to make the Ninth Pass world building make sense. I don't think that succeeds particularly well either, but it's clearly something that she at least saw as a problem that she needed to address.
But we'll get there.
I don't know that it necessarily actually was, but that's how she felt about it. It's clear.
Yeah, I think it is reasonable to say that some of the world building that you end up with in the Ninth Pass feels like a bit of a leap. It feels weird. How did we end up here specifically? And the answer is because Anne McCaffrey wanted to end up here specifically rather than because it seems logical or natural or inevitable that a human society will end up there. But I don't think trying to establish one specific time when the entire society pivoted to that decision or choice or way of thinking and having that one specific time be 19 years after they landed on this planet really solves the problem.
Yeah.
So there are several things here where I'm like, I actually think it makes more sense if this developed gradually over literally hundreds, if not thousands of years, than if you're proposing that 19 years after they landed, because Peter Hanrahan did one specific thing, everyone on the planet did that specific thing forever and ever after that.
Yeah, frankly, I feel like almost all of the things in the Ninth Pass that I look at and be like, huh, how did they get from us presumably enlightened liberal space future to feudalism are answered by them arriving on the planet in Dragonstone and immediately singing Home on the Range. I'm like, oh, now I understand how they got where they ended up. I can see why she didn't feel that way, but yes, frankly, I did not particularly enjoy the story. I did not think it was very interesting, and all of the world building came down to, oh, there's the first Weir Woman, oh, there's the first Tithe, oh, there's the first this, there's the first that, there's the first this other thing. Wow, all at once. What a coincidence. Isn't that convenient? It just felt lazy.
Mm-hmm. And I definitely did notice, and I mentioned to you when I was reading it, things that she didn't bother to explain because they were invisible to her, because she couldn't see past her own preconceptions. So there's a moment when Mahdi is cleaning the wooden chest that has come all the way from Ireland to Pern, to the southern continent, and now to the northern continent, and is being finally set up in Ruathahold forever and ever, etc. So she's busy and she can't feed the baby. And so obviously what happens is that her tween-age daughter feeds the baby while the baby's father stands and drinks a cup of coffee and looks at them.
Excuse you, not coffee, claw.
Yeah, sorry, a cup of claw and looks at them. And that's not something that McCaffrey is trying to logic, right? She's not trying to explain the sexism that we get in the Ninth Pass in a lot of ways, because that sexism is already there when they hit the planet in Dragon's Dawn, because that sexism is there when she's writing this in 1993.
Yeah, well, more to the point, she actually does try to explain the sexism in the Ninth Pass, but she does it in Dragon's Eye. I don't think she's attempting to do it here, and I don't think she was attempting to do it in Dragon's Dawn. Clearly, sexism is still there. But I don't think that she perceives many of the things that we look at and are like, oof. I don't think that she was necessarily perceiving that as sexism. I think she was perceiving that as enlightened space future with gender difference.
And so that is fascinating to me in the way that it's always cool to see science fiction attempt to predict the future and be unable to escape the present. The same way that in my tapes in the survey, these little moments of, okay, you're doing your best, you're trying to imagine a space future, and you're writing this in the 90s and you can't entirely get away from that.
Yeah.
So what do we learn in terms of that world building?
One thing we learned that I had forgotten we learned until I went back, because when I said the first werewoman, I knew that was wrong, but I couldn't remember what it actually was. The first headwoman is established here. But also the other things that I listed are like, that's the first Roth and Runner Beast, that's the first Tithe, and those are the first fosterlings. So rather than taking fosterage as what it is, which is an extremely common social arrangement in many different societies around the world, and in particular common in feudal societies, especially in high social strata, but really at all levels of society for different reasons, and sort of taking it for granted that that's something that could or would develop on Pern, McCaffrey has to be like, oh, well, 6,000 people died of a plague, so there's a lot of orphans, and they were all assigned to foster parents. You didn't need to explain this, actually. It made sense before.
That was a mystery that did not need solving. But I did enjoy hearing about everyone dying horribly of the plague, because that's exactly the kind of reader I am. I'm the kind of person who does a whole podcast episode about plagues. So it was interesting to see that we have this big dramatic, the fever year. And that's where we do get Emily Bull dies, Ezra Caroon dies, some of the named characters from Dragon's Dawn. But it's also not the first or only one, because it's not possible that this was the fever that killed all of the Dolphineers, or at least not probable, because that would not have resulted in the memory of Dolphineers and Dolphineering being lost. You still have a bunch of adults who remember Dolphineers and know that the dolphins are capable of communication.
Yeah, well, and then they still have the Dolphineers gear, presumably, even if they had all died, and they still have access to computer programs, presumably including at least some instructional materials for how to scuba dive, which is, I think, probably the biggest practical obstacle to reestablishing the Dolphineers if they had all died.
So it seems that this is going to be an ongoing problem. And we also specifically are informed that vaccination is being carried out here. So we know they still know how to vaccinate people. But that does, to me, become even more curious in the context of, one, well, why are they having all these fevers back to back to back? It's possible that the bathing facilities in Fort Hold are not ideal, or at least are severely overtaxed. Because part of what people are excited about coming to this new hold is like, wow, we can take baths. So if basic hygiene is not being supported in Fort Hold, I think I know why you're getting all of these fevers, guys.
Yeah, my instinct is that hygiene facilities at Fort Hold are overtaxed severely because it's so crowded. We know even after 6,000 people died of the plague, it's still too crowded at Fort Hold. They still have too many people. There's just not enough space. So first of all, Ruatha is not the second hold. South Bowl is the second hold. That's already been established. Pierre de Courcy went south with people and established a hold there. So Ruatha would be the third hold. They're clearly conscious of this as a problem. It's just a matter of whether and where they can find enough space for people that is safely accessible also. They have to know the routes, that know there are safe travel locations. So Ruatha fits the bill because it's 2 days' ride, and Threadfall at this point is passing over this region roughly every 3 or 4 days. depending. So 2 days is usually safe enough that if you leave right after one Threadfall, you can arrive before the next one.
And I think the implication is that as they are trying to move further and establish what we will learn in the next short story is Tillichold, they have to build temporary shelters on the way ahead of time. Yeah. They need to coordinate with the Dragon Riders. It's a more complicated process.
Which brings us back to one of the things we discussed in the demographics bonus episode, which is the limiting factor for human expansion on Pern is not any of the things that are normally a limiting factor for human settlements expanding. It is the lack of safe stone-covered or metal-coverable spaces to enter Threadfall. That's what conditions how small and weirdly distributed their population is, even into the Ninth Pass.
And at this point, they do still have stone cutters, but they're clearly being very conscious of trying to use them less and trying to conserve power because they know it's not going to last that much longer. And this does align with what we have vaguely picked up in the Ninth Pass and in later books, where they know that, okay, some of the holds and the weirs have clearly been carved out of the rock in some special way that we can no longer understand. And it's incredibly smooth cuts, and many of them are instead just roughly or more hand-hewn, even if hand-hewn by talented artisans who made it quite impressive. To that point, I think what McCaffrey does a good job of in this short story is giving us the information about what has happened since the crossing and laying the scene without it being too exposition-y in a way that, to me, it gives you an interesting level of curiosity and like, ooh, this is kind of fun, this is interesting, and doesn't belabor it. I think, again, her information control remains very good.
That I will accept. I do think that the story handles its own background well. It's when it's trying to give you background for future things that it becomes very clunky, like the extended and unnecessary explanation of Fosterage. This didn't need to be here. We didn't need to hear about this at all. It was fine.
I wasn't that curious, guys.
But yes, its explanation of how you get from the Dolphin's Bell and the end of Dragon's Dawn to this story, that I do think is good.
We also get some interesting hints about fire lizards and why fire lizards have faded away.
Yes, although I don't think they make sense.
That suggests it's mostly about the climate? Which is fascinating because it's not like the climate is any different than it will be in 2,500 years when they bring back a bunch of fire lizards with no difficulty.
Yeah, and I think we don't read the Todd books, but I do think that it's possible that the things we learn about fire lizards at that point, namely that there was a fire lizard plague, suggest that that was something that she also was still kind of puzzling over and thought she had not adequately accounted for.
Well, I don't like that either.
Yeah.
I think a much better explanation is the fact that the fire lizards keep going back to the southern continent to lay their eggs.
Right, she gives us two explanations. One is fewer and fewer fire lizards are staying with their human partners because they don't like the climate, so they're going back south. But we also are told that, oh, the reason there are so few fire lizards is because they go back and lay their eggs at the place where they hatched. And I'm like, that makes no sense. This species could not evolve that way because they would all be laying their eggs all in the same place. And that's not what happens. This is something that is stated in the Ninth Pass books, but it doesn't make sense there either.
Okay, but what we do know about fire lizard habits is that they do lay their eggs secretly, right? Beauty just leaves and won't tell Mentally where her eggs are. So I could believe that they don't know where they're laying their eggs and they are theorizing, oh, like a turtle, they're going back to where they were born. Clearly, they don't have a lot of bandwidth to worry about this. It's on the southern continent. It's inaccessible. So sad, too bad. I also think, although not obviously a perfect overlap, the people who were super invested in fire lizards mostly are either old enough that they're dying of an older generation now, or were dragon riders, right? Because all of the young people who were super into fire lizards at this point, I think, have become dragon riders.
Yeah.
Because that was the pool that they were pulling from. So they might be less than invested in, oh, I have to figure out where my fire lizard laid her eggs so that other people can get fire. Like, no, we're fine. We have dragons now.
True. Yeah. Because they don't have the political pressures that prompt that move in the Ninth Pass.
And also just their population isn't that big. Most of the people who want to be dragon riders can be.
Yeah, true.
They're expanding the number of dragon riders relative to the size of their population at a staggering rate compared to any other time in Pernice history. In less than a decade, they're going to have 4 weirs.
And already at this point, they have like 500 dragons.
Yeah.
That's what we're told is the ideal for a full weir, but also it is suggested that that's an overfull weir, in fact, in the ninth pass, as it clearly is here.
Although, too, these dragons are much smaller than the dragons will be in the ninth pass.
Yes, true.
So 500, slightly bigger than a horse dragons, compared to 300, the size of a 747 dragons, right?
Yeah.
Which would you rather fight? 500 Karanaths or one Ramoth?
Imagine.
One of the places that she's slightly clumsily trying to line up the continuity and trying to preemptively justify or back logic her previous world building is the way that the feudalism is happening hot and heavy here.
Yeah.
And she sort of lampshades it within the text in a way that's like, do you think that this is normal? Do you think that this is weird? Do you think that we think this is weird?
So everyone's been asking Red, what are you going to call the hold? And he's like, I don't know. The name will come when it's ready. And he's brainstorming with Mahdi, and we have this. Hanrahan Hold, he'd asked, almost facetiously. Good heavens, no. That smacks of Lord of the Manor. Mahdi, what do you think is happening here? Do you not know how being a landlord works? That is what you are about to become, is the Lord of the Manor, literally.
And also, the way that it's constructed, it says that Gruath a Hold is not just Peter Hanrahan's land grant. It is his stake combined with others who have come with him. So presumably that's Mary's stake, what she's entitled to, possibly that of the fosterlings that they take in. It's unclear whether they inherit their deceased parents' land rights, the other smaller land grants that come with the adult craftspeople and the skilled workers who are coming with them. But it's Red Hanrahan's hold.
Yeah.
So he's already subsuming their land rights within his land rights in some ways.
Yeah.
And he's clearly making unilateral decisions about this community and the way it will be established.
And this to me is the thing. I think she still thinks that the groundwork for feudalism has not been established, is how it feels to me with that moment of lampshading. That clearly to me suggests that McCaffrey thinks Mahdi Hanrahan is right and they are not becoming the Lord of the Manor yet, and that that transition will happen at some later point. But I just don't think that's true. Because what we're seeing very clearly here is a stage after, in fact, the first step of feudalism, which is making it possible for one person to hold a lot of land that people under them are delegated to work on. So for me, the thing that needed explanation in this is not how did Ruatha Hold get established or any of that. It's how did Red Hanrahan come to be the stakeholder for all of Ruatha? Did the other people grant him their land rights in some capacity? And if so, why? What did they get out of this? Is it that he claimed the hold proper and everyone else is like, there are no other good locations nearby. I guess I need to cede my land rights to Red Hanrahan in order to have access to the hold proper that he's claimed. Because if so, that's extremely sleazy and makes him look really bad. None of the things that are in the story or in later texts by way of illustrations of how feudalism on Pern developed explain this initial step that's missing here. And for me, that's the thing that I have the most questions about in terms of why later land tenure on Pern works the way it does.
Yeah, the exact lines that we get are, the extent of his legitimate stake, combined with the acreage of those who had joined him in the enterprise, added up to a considerable hunk of real estate, as Brian put it. So joined him in the enterprise sounds sort of like shareholders in a larger concern, like that they do have still their land rights within this larger land rights, except that, again, he's just exercising unilateral judgment over things like what to name it and what to plant where and who should be in charge of what. So
is he the CEO? Are we supposed to think of the holds as corporations that everyone is a shareholder in, but no individual smallholder has the voting power to unilaterally overturn decisions of the CEO?
That honestly doesn't seem wrong from the way this is lined up, in that it feels like a bunch of people are like, okay, we like and trust Red's judgment. We think he would be good at being in charge of this. Let's all combine our land and let him make decisions about how best to utilize it that we will carry out and then reap the hypothetical profits of all together.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to maybe put a pin in this and come back to it when we do get to Dragon's Eye and talk about what exactly we think the charter rights are.
Because there is also that little flag line. It's actually in the same paragraph as talking about his stake in the land rights. It's the sheer drudgery of plowing, sowing, and weeding. And I'm like, So is that intentionally laying the groundwork for a class of unpaid laborers who are just going to somehow happen over the next 1,000 years? What are we signaling here? Or is it just that you chose that word?
Yeah, that we're definitely going to have to talk about when we get to Dragon's Eye, because we get to see an early phase of unfree labor on Pern.
Yeah, there are some interesting nuggets. There's some food for thought mixed into an otherwise slightly boring short story. We also get some fascinating information about names, since this is fundamentally a story about naming things. And I gotta say, I'm gonna come out firm with almost all of the naming decisions that are made in this short story are bad.
You are correct. First of all, we have to talk about Ezramil, which is Ezra Karun plus Emily Bowles' names squished together. And everyone's like, oh, what a good name. We need more Pernese names like that. We got to leave behind those old Earth names. Do you hear yourselves? It's a horrible name.
And I really think it does, honestly, make me believe that that's why the Dragon Rider names got started. The dragons were doing it, and they were like, oh, that's cute, haha. And then some poor son of a bitch like Ezramil was like, no, no, the dragons are doing it. We definitely have to all start doing this too. Because, oh my gosh, it's a crime. It's child abuse. You're harming this little innocent baby who did not consent to being named Ezramil.
Unfortunately, the thing about it is all of the other children that Ezramil is growing up with are also going to have these weird fucked up names. So they're not even going to know that they're weird and fucked up. So I think Ezramil's probably going to be fine. There's not going to be any name-based bullying.
It's true. What is Fëanor's real name?
Fëanorin or Fëanorin, depending on the audiobook reader.
Fëanorin does not have any high ground to bully Ezramil. It's all bad.
Yeah.
I shudder to think what Fenaldril's name was before it was Fenaldril.
Surely it was just Fenaldril or something like that.
I love that you're telling yourself that.
That is what I'm telling myself.
I think that's a charming streak of optimism that you hold in your heart.
But we also get another account of the name of Ruatha, which, as we discussed in the past, is from Irish. Although here it's just referred to as the old language. She can't even be bothered to call it. Even Gaelic would be preferable to this, but I'm going to link in the episode and on the website a piece by Orla Ní Gual titled Do Fantasy Writers Think Irish is Just Discount Elvish that is pointed and relevant here.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of names, there's two other quick things. One is we were puzzling over Gheorghe Logarides, who the wiki identifies as Gheorghe, which is a name that shows up as the name of someone who is based at Thessaly, which we know is where the Logarides family is, in Dragonstone.
Specifically, I think, as the person who owns Thessaly's stake, or whose stake Thessaly is.
Yeah.
So it seems like the patriarch of the Logarides family.
People who edit the wiki have concluded that Gheorghe and Gheorghe are the same person, and that this is just, I guess, a Turan-Tatan name situation. I don't know that there's necessarily a strong reason to think that, because that's fully Anne McCaffrey changing his ethnicity when Logarides is so clearly Greek. And it just seems weird for her to have intentionally been like, ah, this guy has a Hungarian name, and then later been like, ooh, no, that was wrong. I should have given him a sort of off-brand Romanian name instead. It just seems like a weird choice. I think they're two separate people.
But if they're two separate people who are in the Logarides family, that doesn't solve the conundrum. One brother has a Hungarian name and one brother has a Romanian name, and they're both very similar. Many name crimes are being committed, but I don't think that you would name two of your children those two names. I hope not.
We both literally know someone whose sister has the same name as her, but slightly different. So it is well within the realm of real possibility.
Well, yes, but their parents committed crimes. I'm not saying that it can't happen. I'm saying that it would be a crime.
What I think I would say is, one, do we know that the Logarides family are the only people who are at Thessaly?
No, but the context in which Paul Bendin is talking about Gheorghe is to try and rebut Tubberman. Like, hey, it's not falling on Thessaly's stake because Gheorghe is angry at us. He's being used synecdochally to represent the stake, which implies that Gheorghe is the one in charge of Thessaly's stake. And here, that does seem to be how Gheorghe is being described as the head of the Logarides family.
I'm just choosing to believe that they're two separate people because Turan Tatan, I can think of plausible explanations for that. They came forward in time and there was already a Bendon rider named Tatan, and Turan very graciously, atypically, was like, I'll just change my name, no big deal.
He was feeling good.
Listen, it was day one in the future. I absolutely could see him being like, oh, I am your magnanimous savior, and to show that.
True.
Because it gives him so much moral high ground.
Especially if his name already had an R in it.
Yeah.
And he just didn't take that part originally.
Yeah. So I am willing to accept that headcanon for why Tatan's name changed, but I don't think there is any plausible explanation you could give me in world for why Georg and Gorge, why that name change happened.
Maybe Paul Bendon, like me, is bad with names.
Well, my other explanation was that Paul Bendon is a Turanian nationalist and is magyarizing Gorge's name as a political point for some reason, but that seems a little bit implausible.
No, I think that's the world-building hill that I'm going to die on now.
I think the most likely explanation is that McCaffrey was like, I need to give a reason for Lord Grogi's name to be that. And I was like,
no, you didn't.
It could have just been future George. That would have been fine.
Yeah.
Especially because, okay, this is just mainly me being petty.
Please. This whole podcast is us being petty, Faye. Embrace it.
Yes. So Red Hound Rahan makes a big deal about how I need to get out first before the Logarides and the Gallianis can get out there and establish their holds, because I need to make my hold the best place for horses. We're going to have the best horses on the whole planet. Fuck livestock animals.
Cows are boring.
Horses are where it's at. And I'm going to put the Logarides and the Gallianis in their place. And it is true that Ruatha is the place for horses. It's also true that Karun, which presumably was founded by either the Logarides or the Gallianis or both, is the site of the Beastcraft Hall. So it seems like Red Hanrahan maybe won the battle but lost the war on that front. But also, if what I think is a logical conclusion from the way this interaction is presented in the story, that Karun was established by either the Logarides or the Gallianis or both, if that's correct, that raises questions about why is Lord Grogi the Lord of Forthold then? Maybe she just wanted to establish that this kind of name was in the pool somewhere, but it seems like a weird choice.
I could also believe that the Gallianis established the Beasthold and the Logarides stayed in Forthold.
Maybe. Well, especially because we later learn that Paul Bendon is not, in fact, the patriarch of Forthold, right?
Right.
Joel Lilienkamp succeeds him, and then possibly not Joel Lilienkamp's children.
But also, people could intermarry, right? It's entirely possible that Joel Lilienkamp's daughter marries a Logarides, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so one of the other things that's revealed in this story is the initial impetus to abandon surnames, which is we're breaking with the Earth past, basically. So we'll just be Ezramil of Fort Weir, right?
Ezramil of Fort Weir, Ryan of... What are you naming this place? It'll come to us. The right name will come to us.
Yeah, but A, this only works if everyone has unique names, which, to be fair, they are proposing. And B, this only works if everyone stays in one place. So you can see why the Lilienkamp traders, who are presumably descended from Joel Lilienkamp, have the surname that they do, because it was advantageous for them to have something that would identify them collectively because they don't belong to a specific hold.
Yeah.
In retrospect, of all the people that she could have identified as their ancestor, it does seem a little weird that it was Joel Lilienkamp, the supply officer who wants everything to be in its place and to know where everything is, and not... one of the traveler kids could be an ancestor. Some indication that any aspect of the ethnic nomads, quote-unquote, culture survived into the Ninth Pass would have been nice.
But no.
But it seems instead...
You are genetically predisposed to care about supply and demand? Genetically merchant-y.
Yeah, and that your itinerant practices are sui generis rather than being any kind of inherited tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Just a weird choice.
And another place where it does not actually make as much sense to me that everyone would look around one day and go, we should just stop using last names, effective now, as it does that practice would be gradually lost over time as it ceased to have utility or as it was unclear because you needed to identify people by their place of origin or by their trade in some way.
Yeah.
But in all of this stuff that is being named, we don't get any information on why they called it a weir.
This drives me bonkers. Why, of all of the things that she could have chosen to explain, all of the Pern words, all of these naming practices, the names of the holds, the names of the random specific creatures, the fact that they spend so much time telling us wherries are named because they look like barges. You explain all of that, and never once do you comment on the fact that your dragons, the most important characters in the whole series, the most important element of all of your world building, live in places called weirs. Where the fuck did that word come from?
I always vaguely assumed it was connected to eerie, but that was truly just me in my tweens making an assumption.
It doesn't look like there's any explanation.
It just sounded cool.
Not a huge deal in the grand scheme of things, but of all of the things that she chose to explain, given all of the things that she chose to explain, the fact that she chose not to explain this is very weird to me.
Very weird, you might say?
One of the other things that we wanted to talk about was, again, the racial politics. In particular, because I spent some time as I was reading it puzzling over what hold Ziongola is founding.
Yeah.
Because it's a little unclear in this story, and only in the second Weir, the next story, do we find out specifically that it's Tilik hold. So knowing that Angola is going to found a hold, first of all, that raises one of the recurring questions that I have had since Dragon's Dawn. Why is there not an Angola hold?
It's definitely a choice.
Person who was primarily responsible for the defense of the colony. Seems like maybe important.
And just everyone seems to like him. Everyone else has some drama with somebody, but Angola just seems like a chill guy.
There's fucking Bitra and Limos hold and Nabol hold, but there's no Angola hold. Come on.
Right.
And on one level, I'm like, that has to be because Angola is black. But also, here it was weird because I was like, wait, we just had this long story about Tilik, and all of the other holds and places that have been named seem to be named memorially, so it seems a little weird to be naming a place for Jim Tilik while he's alive, but then we find out in the second Weir that he's died at some point in the intervening time, which, you know, it makes sense, he was in his 60s already, but it's a little bit like, oh, okay, fine. In any case, Angola is the founder of Tilik Hold. Assuming that the pattern from Ruatha Hold follows, that suggests that Angola is the originator of the Tilik Hold bloodline. I don't think this makes a huge difference, because obviously it's been 2,500 years, and the racial dynamics of the colonists are no longer in effect. But knowing this, I do think that in retrospect, we were correct that we should be reading Bryla, who we know is what, granddaughter of Lord Odorol?
I think so, yeah.
I think this is an indication that we are in fact meant to read Bryla as, at the very least, not white, if not specifically black.
Mm-hmm.
For better or for worse. Probably for worse.
Yeah, well, and we get a very, I'm tempted to say very 90s, portrayal of race here, in that when Paul and Peter are talking about the people who will be going with them to found this new hold.
Among the Fosterlings, there seemed to be at least one representative from every ethnic group, and Paul wondered if Red had done that on purpose.
One, I love the confidence of every ethnic group. Every single one in these 141 people.
Mm-hmm.
And two, this approach of, yeah, we have this tidy array of different people, and I'm just throwing all these different names in there, and maybe they're Greek, and maybe they're Romanian, and maybe they're Hungarian, and I'm just kind of dumping it all in there, and I'm confident that this is a good world-building choice in a way that I think represents her optimism or her intentions, unfortunately, that she does not really live up to in terms of actually crafting nuanced and interesting characters of color or characters with a specific ethnic heritage that seems meaningfully incorporated into the story in any way.
Yeah, it also positions Ruatha as a kind of utopian melting pot. Once again, Ruatha is the specialist place in the world.
And yet, it's the specialist because it's the most Irish, but it's not the most Irish, but it boggles the mind.
Irishness in superposition.
Yeah.
When you observe it, the wave function collapses, and it always collapses on the side of Ruatha's very Irish.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow, it always coincidentally turns out that that's the most important part and not the ethnic melting pot.
And then the last thing that I wanted to talk about was what we see about their medical capacities and their technological capacities at this point, 20 years in, about a decade after the first Threadfall. They signpost a couple of times in the story that we are stepping down to a lower level of technology, that we are running out of the power packs, the high-tech things, and we see the door from one of the shuttles getting repurposed into Ruatha. And I do think that's a little bit of a fun Easter egg, because we know that Ruatha's door is special, that it's unique enough that Lessa is able to use it to time travel for the first time. I don't think she intended that when she originally wrote Dragonflight, but I think it is possible to read this to mean that this door is still the door of Ruatha Hole 2,500 years later.
Yeah, it seems at the very least like she probably had, oh, Ruatha has a special door in mind when she wrote this story.
But more specifically, we get a dragon rider dying in childbirth of postpartum hemorrhage, which is fascinating to me because, yes, that is something that does just happen sometimes when people are giving birth. It's not unusual complication. I think it's like 5%, but it just sort of shows up. But the treatments for it ultimately are give the person who is bleeding out more blood. And it seems very surprising to me that they've gotten to the point where they can't do a blood transfusion only a decade after the first Threadfall. Like, what do you need to give someone a blood transfusion? You need to know their blood type. Allianne was born before they came to Pern, if she's old enough that she is
one of the first dragon riders.
So they would know her blood type. And you need a sterile needle and some tubing. And you need another person with the same blood type or a universal donor. And that's kind of what you need. Maybe more than one other person if it's a really serious hemorrhage. So the fact that they were not able to save her life suggests that either they didn't have those things or there was some error or breakdown in the process. Something went wrong beyond just she was in a medical emergency.
Yeah, there's an implication. Sean says, I went to get Basil, right?
Yeah.
Who we know from Dragon's Dawn is an obstetrician. This kind of suggests that Basil might be the only obstetrician.
Because what Sean says is, we couldn't stop the bleeding. I went for Basil. So
that also raises questions like, why was he not there already?
Clearly, they didn't think it was a high-risk pregnancy. But a dragon can teleport. So how long can it take you to go get a doctor who's in Fort Hold if you're in Fort Weir?
Yeah, since we know, well, we will know when we both reread Master Hopper of Pern that it's close enough that the apprentice is used to make day trips up to, you know, spend the night at the spooky empty Weir before the beginning of the Ninth Pass.
And obviously it is possible to diegetically come up with an explanation. Maybe Allianne had a super rare blood type. This, that. Basil twisted his ankle. He could only hobble. Who knows what was going on? Someone else was having a high-risk pregnancy at exactly the same time in Fort Hold, and he was in the middle of a C-section. Who can say? But clearly, extra diegetically, McCaffrey wants to let the reader know that at this point, only 20 years after landing, women are dying in childbirth again. And I think that's an interesting signifier of how she's thinking of the technological regression and the way life on Pern is changing, because it is a benchmark for what is the life of a person who can get pregnant like. In 21st century America, although unfortunately changing month by month at this point, you know the amount of risk you are in if you choose to get pregnant. There is always a risk to your life, but it's not a significant risk. And I think McCaffrey wants to position, okay, like on Pern, this is now a significant risk.
Yeah, it raises also the fact that it's specifically connected with pregnancy will lead us in the future to discussions about the changing status of women on Pern, including already in the next story, The Second Weir, when we talk about gay people, because they're back.
They're back.
Or, well, one gay person is back.
It's something that I know McCaffrey was thinking about because she does have the short story about gestational surrogacy that she wrote in the 50s. She is a writer who is thinking about how I think she would probably have equated women and people who can get pregnant, but she is thinking about that in science fiction contexts.
Yeah.
And has been at this point for 30 or 40 years.
Yeah. And I think given the ways that pregnancy appears in the Ninth Pass books, we are meant to see the changing status of pregnancy as the beginning of a through line that connects the status of women in the First Pass to the status of women in the Ninth Pass.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily going to be a linear trajectory, although in some ways Dragon's Eye suggests that it is kind of a linear trajectory, but that we're supposed to see these things as connected.
But we'll get there.
And we will get there.
my recommendation is not, I think, a particularly close match to The Ford of Red Hanrahan, but it is also a story about a community coming together to build something new, or rather a group of people who weren't really a community coming together to form a community for the first time. And it's called The Year Without Sunshine by Naomi Kritzer, and it is available to read in Uncanny Magazine.
My recommendation is also not a great match, but it is a story about multiple perspectives on a particular community and the question of whether that community is a utopia, and if so, for whom or from whose perspective, who needs utopia. And it is An Account of the Land of Witches by Sophia Samatar, which was published in her short story collection Tender, but is also available online, and there will be a link to that on the website.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Dragons Made Me Do It. If you enjoyed it and want to hear more, you can follow us on Tumblr at dmmdipodcast.tumblr.com for updates or to send us questions or comments, and you can find our archive of episodes along with transcripts, recommendations, funny memes, and more at dmmdipodcast.neocities.org, NEO Cities.